This is Audible.
Blackstone Publishing presents The Last Equation of Isaac Severy, a novel in clues by Nova Jacobs. This book is read by Lisa Flanagan. For Jeremy. An intelligence that, at a given instant, could comprehend all the forces by which nature is animated and the respective situation of the beings that make it up. If, moreover, it were vast enough to submit these data to analysis, for such an intelligence nothing would be uncertain, and the future, like the past, would be open to its eyes. Pierre-Simon Laplace, A Philosophical Essay on Probabilities, 1814. Prologue. On the morning he was to die, the old man woke early and set about making breakfast. He put eggs to boil, bread to toast, tea to steep. And as he did so, felt he understood why prisoners on death row request such commonplace meals on the eves of their executions. They didn't crave elaborate spreads of coq au vin, foie gras, octopus salad, oysters on ice. These poor souls longed for burgers, fried chicken, pizza, ice cream. Whenever he would come across reports of these ill-fated Last Suppers, it was the childlike ones that got to him most. The strawberry shortcake eaten by Chicago serial killer John Wayne Gacy before his lethal injection. Or that kid in Texas, Jeffrey Allen Barney, who said he was very sorry for what he had done to that woman, and asked only for a carton of milk and 2 boxes of Frosted Flakes. The old man, too, had simple tastes. Though he was by nearly all standards a man of culture, his culinary preferences were aggressively ordinary. He had enjoyed a variation on the same breakfast for as long as he could remember. Why stop now that someone was coming for him? He did, however, prepare 2 of everything, arranging 2 cups and saucers and 2 egg spoons on the breakfast tray. Animals escaping the flood, he thought, as he placed 2 brown soft-boiled eggs side by side. He had always been a generous host, and he would be one to the last. Besides, it was early, and his visitor would no doubt be hungry. And how about some music to make the proceedings more pleasant? He selected a well-loved classical CD and pressed play on the living room stereo. Sunrise was still an hour away when, with only ambient light from the kitchen to guide him, he carried the tray to his usual spot at the far end of the yard. A cafe table sat ready, with 2 chairs beside a jacuzzi platform. He arranged the sets of plates, napkins, and cutlery, and took a seat on the side of the table facing the yard, his back to the fence. He poured Earl Grey from a pot into one of the teacups and glanced at his watch. The phosphorescent face read 5:35. He still had time to escape, to get in his old Cadillac and drive somewhere far from here. But he was done being afraid. He was ready to die. All he had to do now was wait. Part 1. Chapter 1. The Merchant. The Resurrection Cemetery sounded to Hazel Severy more like a threat than a place of peace and final repose, but as far as she could tell, it was shaping up to be a lovely service. Her grandfather's casket, draped in white roses and gold embroidery, positively glowed in the Southern California sun. If there had been any doubts that Isaac Severy, a Catholic suicide, would receive a proper send-off with the full regalia, those doubts were now dispelled. From her seat among the chairs arranged on the vast mortuary lawn, Hazel glanced around at mourners' faces both familiar and strange. Her hand went to the pocket of her dress trousers, into which she had slipped an unopened envelope not an hour before. It had arrived that morning inside an overnight FedEx packet, mailed from her store. Assuming it was a bill or some other piece of bad news, Hazel had groaned when she saw the package with her name sitting on her brother's breakfast table. But when she tore open the sleeve, she found a small blue envelope with a sticky note from her sole employee. "This came for you the day you left. Chet." It wasn't a bill or an eviction notice. It was a letter from her grandfather. More precisely, her adoptive grandfather, the man whose body now lay in that attractive walnut box. The envelope was one of those candy-striped airmail types, a nostalgic indulgence of his. Isaac's name appeared nowhere on the envelope, but the address of her Seattle bookstore was written in his shaky hand. The postmark read October 16th. On October 17th, he would be dead. She stared at the winged par avion, at a stamp featuring a sunflower, and felt increasingly lightheaded. It was too much to take in, this unexpected missive from the dead. So she slipped it into her pocket unopened. In fact, she thought she might let the reading of it forever remain a future possibility. As long as the envelope was sealed, she would have one last communication waiting from Isaac. She had brought the letter with her to the funeral as an odd sort of comfort. But as she sat in the unusually blistering October sun, watching her grandfather's casket warp and buckle behind her own tears, she pushed a corner of the envelope deep under a fingernail, until it stung. The call had come a week ago. She had been pacing her Pioneer Square bookstore, hatching a desperate scheme to abandon her life, one that involved either disappearing into a country of exotic coordinates or landing in debtor's prison. She loved Seattle, and she loved her store. In a mostly unstable life, books had been the only reliable refuge she had known. But she now owed a figure so large she was certain there must be a corresponding digital ticker somewhere, climbing upward daily like the national debt. The bleat of her store phone had interrupted her thoughts. She picked up the receiver, mustering her usual bright greeting. "The Gattersnipe, can I help you find a book?" After a pause, the halting voice of her brother Gregory told her that their beloved Isaac had been found dead in his backyard. By his own hand. The housekeeper had chanced upon him that morning in his jacuzzi. A set of live Christmas lights coiled in the water with him, one of its bulbs crushed. Hazel couldn't have said how long the conversation lasted, or in her deep disbelief how many times she had made her brother repeat himself. She knew only that when she closed up her store immediately afterward, the sun had set, and she was exhausted from crying. But she wouldn't be going home. Having lost her apartment in Belltown weeks before, she was now living in the narrow space behind her shop. The back room was cramped and airless, with barely enough space for her mattress. She had moved most of her things into storage, bought a mini-fridge, and begun sponge bathing at the bathroom sink. She had told no one of her indignity, not even Bennett, her boyfriend of almost 2 years. Every night she exited her shop for the benefit of whoever might be watching, maintaining the ritual of locking up and walking to the bus stop before doubling back to re-enter her store from the alley. Better confined to the back than spotted through the shop's windows at odd hours by her landlord. This wasn't the first time she had been homeless. She supposed it was in her DNA. "And what is DNA?" Isaac had once asked, "but an invisible roadmap of how our lives will play out." If that were true, Isaac's own genetic GPS had sent him careening off course. That night, as she sat cross-legged on the mattress, eyes parched from evaporated tears, she recalled a curious detail from her conversation with Gregory. Isaac had prepared 2 breakfasts for himself that morning, one half-eaten, the other untouched. She had heard vague reports of his absent-mindedness, but in her weekly phone calls to him he had sounded as quick as ever, always armed with amusing stories, and never repeating the ones she'd already heard. At 79 years old, Isaac had been remarkably healthy. He had looked no older than 65, and the only ailment she had known him to have was his lifelong struggle with migraines. Migraines ran in the family. But mental illness? Depression? Had she been so consumed with her own daily battles that she had missed something obvious? Now, as she stared at his casket, She felt a fresh stab of shame. She removed her hand from her pocket and returned it to her lap. What if she had been the only one to receive anything that might be defined as a suicide note? As the priest appeared and began to speak, Hazel couldn't help but study those family members around her for hints that they, too, had received a surprise delivery. Most of the fair-skinned, light-eyed Severy clan had chosen seats shaded by the surrounding sycamores. Strange, though, how this Nordic-blooded family thrived in even seemed to prefer the merciless southwest sun. It was rare for a Severy to permanently stray east of the Rockies or north of Napa Valley. Few had ever moved outside a 25-mile radius of Pasadena's Caltech. It was she alone with the dark eyes and hair who had succumbed to gloomier regions. If any of the family had received a letter from the dead, their expressions betrayed nothing but ordinary grief. Only Gregory, seated across the aisle, his 2-year-old son passed out on his chest, noticed her studying the crowd. She wondered why they weren't sitting together, considering they'd arrived in the same car. Their separation across the aisle suddenly seemed significant to her, emblematic of a gap that had been widening between them the past couple of years. Having a child did that to a person, certainly. But with Gregory, it sometimes felt as if he were being steadily pulled away from her by a source of gravity she couldn't identify. Her brother gave her a sad smile and returned his attention to the homily.
"Who died?"
Hazel's grandmother, seated beside her, asked no one in particular.
"Isaac Severy,"
Hazel whispered, as if he were a mutual acquaintance.
"Everyone's going these days," Lily mused. "That's what happens when you reach a certain age. It's one long ghoulish parade."
Hazel gave her grandmother's hand a squeeze. She was struck by how pretty she looked, even though she was wearing what appeared to be every necklace she had ever owned, and her eyes had been emptied of their former intelligence. Lily Severy had once been a celebrated translator of Spanish literature, but her mind had faltered in recent years, and for the past few days she had alternated between anguish over a loss she couldn't quite place and a dreamy fascination at all the activity around her. In her more lucid moments, Lily did appear to be aware that she'd been married to a mathematician, though the details were muddled. At the elderly care facility where she now lived, she liked to educate her nurses on her husband's invention of calculus.
"You know, it wasn't that German fellow, like they all say."
The next 2 hours were a warm broth of tears and praise, served up for one of the most beloved academics in Southern California. What seemed an endless procession of Caltech colleagues and students took the microphone and spoke of Isaac's unearthly level of brilliance, not only in the mathematics department, but also in diverse disciplines touched by his acrobatic mind. They spoke of the equations he had created for Caltech's environmental sciences, such as the ones that could anticipate the complex movement of oil spills, the ever-changing paths of migratory birds, and the erratic pattern of melting ice in the Arctic. They spoke of his ferocious curiosity and of his heart.
"He wasn't just my hero. He was my friend."
There were allusions to Sir Isaac Newton, for whom he had been named. A fitting kinship, joked one of his Jewish colleagues, for here were two Isaacs who, despite all evidence to the contrary, simply must have been Jews. Just as Hazel was growing restless, her Uncle Philip, Isaac's eldest child, stepped behind the microphone. Philip was a lean, delicate man, with hair so light his eyebrows were nearly invisible. As a result, he had a perpetually afflicted look, as if he were under constant assault from light and dust. Today his eyes were hidden behind a pair of dark glasses, but that didn't stop him from squinting every time the sun struck him at a certain angle. He unfolded a piece of paper with his long fingers before peering up at the gathering.
"As many of you know," his fragile voice began, "my father had passions that went beyond mathematics. There was almost nothing that did not interest him. He was a devout scientist, but he was also a religious man who grappled with the entire idea of faith. He then read Emily Dickinson's This World Is Not Conclusion, a poem Hazel remembered well from college, and one that was now making her feel some real affection for this uncle whom she had seen often while growing up, but still barely knew. After struggling through the final stanza, Philip withdrew quickly, leaving behind a restlessness that lasted several minutes. Hazel shifted in her chair, inadvertently catching the eye of Philip's younger sister, Paige, seated half a row down, her stout body swathed in black silk. In her prime, Aunt Paige had been a brilliant political statistician, but she'd apparently done little with her talent in recent years, and her standing in the family was now one of a recluse and grump. She had never married, but there was a grown daughter somewhere. Alexis, was it? Whom no one ever saw. Whether Alexis resided north of Napa or east of the Rockies was anyone's guess, and Hazel didn't spy any likely candidates here today. At last, the queue behind the microphone shrank to zero, and a few people stood. But the sound system gave a startling buzz, calling attention to a young man who appeared before them as if by conjuring trick. He didn't speak right away, taking his time sifting through bits of fuchsia-colored paper. Hazel found something about the man instantly arresting. He sported the beard of a woodsman, but was otherwise dressed in the shabby welfare academic vein. He cleared his throat and spoke in a vaguely British accent.
"Good mathematics is generally impossible to read aloud," he began. "But why should that stop us?"
He laughed nervously, and when no one joined him, he resumed.
"A proof, as many of you know, is a number of true statements leading to a logical conclusion. Proofs are the cornerstone of mathematics and are really meant to be seen, not heard. If, for example, I were to read aloud Andrew Weil's famous proof of Fermat's Last Theorem, which is 150 pages, by the way."
Another laugh.
"We'd be here for days."
"Who is this guy?"
a woman in Hazel's row asked.
"However," the man continued, "what I have here is not a real proof, only fragments scribbled on these cocktail napkins. But what if, as a kind of tribute, I read just a scrap of his work? An everyday bit of fluff floating around his head, so that we might have some idea of what it was like to be Isaac Severy. So I hope you'll indulge me while I read this bit of ordinary mathematics. Let dx over dt equal a times x plus function of x plus epsilon times g of x."
Hazel had a strange urge to laugh. Yet there was something soothing about the cadence of his voice as he delivered this long chain of letters, numbers, and symbols. Isaac would have liked the absurdity of this moment, and she suddenly missed him terribly.
"Is he reading an equation?"
someone behind her whispered.
"You've got to be fucking kidding me."
Hazel didn't take her eyes from the man as he continued his recitation, but her hand had wandered to her right pocket. She slid her fingers inside, over the crispness of the envelope, and before she knew it, she was running a fingernail along the lip until she could feel a thin sheet of paper within. Almost without thinking, she had broken the seal, and now there seemed to be no retreating from Isaac's letter. Chapter 2. The Theorist. Philip Severy had no one left to impress. The full weight of this fact descended upon him as he stood in front of family and strangers, blinking away the lighthouse glare of his father's coffin. His sister Paige had ordered the thing outfitted with white roses and metallic vestments. Had she meant it as some kind of joke? Because if she had intended their father's death box to be both heinous and comically reflective, well, bang up job. Philip pushed his sunglasses flat against his face and struggled through some words he had prepared. When he returned to his seat, his twin sons were wiggling a few chairs down. Their teenage bodies were present, but their minds were no doubt reliving their last tennis match. Silas and Sydney worshipped tennis, lived for it, would probably even die for it in some offshoot universe where one was forced to choose between such things. Death, or a world without tennis. Death, they would chime in unison, before linking arms and marching off the nearest cliff together. They loved the sport in the purest way that one can love a thing, with the whole of their selves. Philip was not like his sons in this way. Not anymore. And it was only now that he knew this with terrible certainty. As another Isaac Severy fan took the podium, Philip's attention wandered to a translucent spider making its way over the charcoal dunes of his slacks. At that moment, the dark folds of cotton twill were this tiny spider's entire known universe. And the sudden intrusion of Philip's forefinger to flick it into the air must have been an extraordinary phenomenon that the spider would never be able to explain. I was there, and then I wasn't. His wife touched his arm.
You were great up there. You all right?
Philip nodded. Why shouldn't he be all right? His father had killed himself a week ago. No reason, no warning. Killed himself. It sounded absurd and wrong, like vicious gossip. Just 2 weeks ago they had been sitting together at his son's final set in the Junior Tennis Open quarterfinals. His father, relaxed that day, had taken a break from questioning Philip on a recent journal article he'd co-authored, and from wondering aloud if the work was up to Philip's usual standards. Watching his twin sons face off against each other, Philip had said, "I forget which one I'm rooting for." His father had smiled.
"Whichever is your favorite."
As the ball went into the net, Philip let out an ambiguous holler directed at neither son in particular. He didn't have a favorite son, because he harbored identical feelings toward all three of his children. Profound dismay at having fathered such unremarkable offspring. He loved them. Of course he loved them. Silas, Sydney, and their much older sister Sybil were beautiful, glowing things who laughed and smiled like he did, and whose eyes were their mother's startling green. But how he, a Stanford MIT-educated particle physicist and professor of theoretical physics at Caltech, and Jane, a Stanford-Harvard molecular biologist by training, if not by profession, had produced three academic mediocrities, never ceased to be a source of bewildering disbelief and low-grade depression. He would periodically unfold the genealogical map in his mind and try to isolate the genetic offender. His own parents certainly weren't to blame. His father, a distinguished professor at Caltech for 40 years, had devoted most of his life to the study of chaos theory and nonlinear dynamics, while his mother had translated Spanish Baroque literature to great acclaim. Jane's mother and father, both doctors, of course, boasted equally impressive levels of accomplishment. But there were suspect siblings on both sides who pointed to genetic weakness. Jane's sister Faye, for one, was clever only when it came to marrying rich men and living off the alimony. His own sister, too, had abundant faults. She had been working on a book on probability for decades, a book some were beginning to suspect didn't exist.
"What's the probability you'll ever finish that thing, eh, Paige?"
But Paige had proven her cleverness in other ways, and her shortcomings were entirely social in nature. And then there was Tom, the youngest of his siblings, a troubling specter who still hovered over them. He had left behind two now-grown foster children, who'd long ago been adopted into the family. Philip had seen them earlier, hadn't he? Yes, there were Hazel and Gregory, seated near the front, their dark, angular faces looking nothing like their adoptive clan. Aside from these two reminders, the family had mostly forgotten how Tom had once moved among them, following his own pained choreography. He had been something to love once, magnetic even, and at one point could easily have been Philip's intellectual rival. Philip wanted to remember that Tom, and not the Tom he had last seen in an orange jumpsuit, trying to contain his hatred for his older brother from behind bulletproof glass. Yes, Thomas Severy was proof positive that there was decay lurking in the family's genetic code. Philip's daughter,
hair spilling down her shoulders like a draft of sunlight, turned in her seat and whispered something to her own daughter, Drew.
Pop-Pop's definitely in heaven, sweetie,
Sybil assured her.
How do you know?
Drew asked.
If you can't see him, how do you know?
Because sometimes you just know,
Sybil explained.
Just like you know my arm is in my sleeve, even if you can't see it.
The little girl frowned.
But, shh, it's quiet time.
As Philip watched a patch of sun play on Sybil's beautiful head, he marveled at how nature had not made at least one of his three children dutifully bright. But then that wasn't how the coin toss of heredity necessarily worked. Good things come in threes, wasn't it? Of course, it could go the other way. And for Philip and Jane Severy, it had come up three indeed. Dumb, dumb, dumb. Jane always protested when Philip expressed disappointment in their children.
Sybil has more social intelligence than the both of us. Have you seen her work a crowd?
She's not the twit you imagine. In Philip's view, the extent of their daughter's effort to prove she wasn't a twit was getting into Stanford 11 years ago. Not without some parental legacy points, naturally. But Sybil had done nothing spectacular during her 6 listless years there, except meet her husband, Jack, get pregnant, and embrace a particularly Jesus-y brand of Christianity. Upon graduation, she had transformed herself into a Sunnyvale wife, mother, and artist. Artist of sorts. For her work, which involved slapping a found object to a canvas, was ghastly. And Philip couldn't see how pieces like shopping list number 15, pine cone number 2, and some garbage I found number 236 were worth getting excited about. He tried his best to focus on the mourners who were lining up to enumerate his father's many qualities. Philip would need to recall these sentiments later at the reception. So kind of you to mention, so thoughtful of you to say, etc. Philip wished he could get out of having to talk to the people who would soon invade his family home. In fact, he wished someone had spared him news of his father's death entirely. He wanted to be told 20 years from now because without his father, the very important role he had been playing for his entire career, Professor Philip Severy in the hunt for the unified field theory, now quite suddenly lacked an audience. In the movie house of his life, had there really been only one person sitting out there all this time? It was now apparent to him that he didn't love his work with the whole of his heart and mind, as he had once believed. But he had loved it for another's sake. And he needed to find a way to restart the show, or be forever regarded as just another annotation in the history of theoretical physics. Forget about Stockholm calling. His days of reliable brain activity were numbered. He was 57. And in these Wild West days of particle collisions, he was feeling increasingly isolated and immaterial. He was running out of time to wrap up the secrets of the universe in one big, elegant bow. Forcing his attention back to his surroundings, Philip noticed that the twins were gone from their seats. He looked to Jane for explanation, but she was focused on yet another stemmy dweeb addressing the crowd. These were his people, of course. But for some reason, Philip could no longer stand it. He stood up and started walking with no particular destination. Just away, over the gently rolling grounds. He spotted his sons in an open expanse of grass, hitting a make-believe ball with make-believe rackets. From this distance, he couldn't tell which son was which. That was, of course, what made their matches so captivating. The two were so similar that it was either boy's victory. His father had tried to impart to the twins the roles of probability and statistics in their game. Tennis, after all, was so temptingly mathematical. Tennis match minus C plus exclamation point equals tennis math. Because they were physically identical, his father would say, in the heat of a game, it probably came down to the angle of the sun, an eddy of air, the tensility of a racket string, or whether the memory of a girl's smile skipped across one of their minds.
We don't think of girls while we're playing, Grandpa, they would groan.
Or at all. It occurred to Philip that tennis and theoretical physics had at least one thing in common. Both favored the young.
As he sat down in a cool spot of grass, taking in their imaginary game, he wished desperately to be his son's age again. Oh, to have a teenage brain. Hell, a 25-year-old brain. Neurons igniting like rods in a lightning field. Philip leaned back against a headstone and wondered if, in those final minutes before the power from a tiny 7-watt bulb shot through the salt water to stop his heart, his father had wished for the same thing.
Chapter 3. The Mathematician.
The man with the beard was still at the podium when Hazel extracted the letter from her pocket and unfolded it. She glanced around quickly for fear of being observed, but the people near her were either focused on the speaker or involved in their own thoughts. The letter was typewritten, which wasn't exactly surprising. Isaac had often saved his penmanship for his math, but he had used his IBM Selectric, an ancient typewriter that duplicated letters and punctuation arbitrarily if one didn't hit the keys in just the right way. He clearly had never bothered to get the machine fixed, or to use correction tape. My dear Hayes, my time is over. This fact has become as clear to me as the crescent moon setting outside my study window as I write this. I wish I could dodge my assassin. I wish I could flee to the Côte d'Azur or somewhere equally beautiful. But our killers find us all. So why flail so desperately? Hazel, I am counting on you to carry out an unpleasant request. I would do it myself were I not being followed. Know that I am of sound mind when I ask that you destroy my work in room 137. Burn. Smash. Reformat the hard drives. I cannot get into why, only that you must do this quickly, before others find it. The equation itself you must keep. I leave it with the family member they would least suspect. Deliver the equation to one man only, John Raspanti. His favorite pattern is herringbone. Important. 1. Do not stay in or visit the house past the end of October. 3. Will die. I am the first. 2. Do not share this with anyone. Do not contact police, even those related to you. Nothing can be done about the above. 3. Once you have committed this letter to memory, destroy it. Shore up your courage, my dear. Eternally, Isaac. Hazel's neck grew warm, and her hands began to tremble. She shut her eyes, and as the words, assassin, destroy, equation, do not share this with anyone, impressed upon her mind, a swarm of dread invaded her chest. But the dread was followed by something else, something subtler, an almost hideous thrill. She drew in a sharp breath, tucked the paper back in her pocket, and tried to return her attention to the service. But fragments of the letter scrolled across her mind. Was her grandfather really suggesting that he had been murdered? Who the hell was John Raspanti? And what did Herringbone have to do with anything? Mathematics continued to pour from the bearded man's mouth, accompanied by sharp hand gestures to emphasize certain symbols. Hazel scanned the crowd, which looked increasingly agitated. She had completely lost track of time, but guessed that the speaker had kept them captive for at least a quarter of an hour. When the man finished and stepped back from the mic, the entire gathering stood at once. Even Lily sprang to her feet. Only Hazel was slow to stand. Her insides had tightened, and her grandmother's earlier words, ghoulish parade, echoed in her ears. For the mourners who managed the 20-mile drive to the Severy home in the Hollywood Hills of Beechwood Canyon, up switchbacks to the house on the bluff, lunch awaited. Hazel again caught a ride with her brother and his wife. As she stepped from the back seat, she opened her eyes wide and inhaled deeply,
hoping to ground herself in sense memory. The two-story Victorian, distinctly out of character in a canyon of Spanish and Normandy revival, had always carried a whiff of bygone imperialism. Its airy perch looked out on Hollywood and the deco domes of the Griffith Observatory. But Hazel thought the decaying clapboard, combined with a healthy population of tropical flora, gave the house an almost colonial feel, like some faded British outpost. Inside, she surveyed the now fatherless objects littering the house. Broken conch shells, moldy campaign buttons, a cast-iron apple corer, a carved piece of bone. A dinner guest had once likened the house to a Joseph Cornell box, each room with its own codified charm, subdivided again by a recessed nook or secret cabinet, and within those niches were still more chambers of discovery, if one knew where to look. Now, as Hazel examined Isaac's curios, they seemed laden with hidden meaning, each one a potential hazard or clue. She stepped into a book-lined alcove, not only to evade the rapidly filling living room, but also to consult with herself as to what the hell she was going to do with the contents of her pocket. From a bookshelf, flagged with family snapshots in lieu of bookmarks, her grandparents had been sentimental that way, she pulled down Newton's Principia Mathematica and plucked from its pages an old photograph of Isaac standing amid roses in L.A.'s Exposition Park. As she directed her growing anxiety at his image, Hazel became aware of a clutch of guests huddled in the next room, none of whom she recognized. Their words were indistinct, yet she sensed they were gossiping about her grandfather.
A bit unhinged, maybe.
She didn't like their tone, and as sometimes happened with her, had been happening as far back as she could remember, Hazel conjured up a scene of comic violence, in which she burst into the room and pelted the group with smoked salmon from the buffet table before jamming a broken schmear knife into a few necks. Then, amid screams and sprays of blood, she fled the house, triumphant. The idiotic image evaporated, and she returned her attention to the photo where her then-middle-aged grandfather was looking overheated in a corduroy jacket. She had seen the snapshot countless times, and had no need to study it now so thoroughly. She was merely delaying the moment when she would have to make herself visible to the mourners roaming the house. Go be with your family. Yes, these people were technically her family, but she had never felt entirely comfortable among them. She could fake it, of course, had faked it for much of her life. But with Isaac gone, her feelings of other were rapidly intensifying. Nearly half the place was filled with mathematicians of one type or another. Growing up, she had thought little about the mental caliber of the guests who filtered through the house. But now, as an adult, Hazel could grasp the critical difference between mathematics and mere arithmetic, and she quickly discovered that there was nothing like a talent for the former to separate pure, distilled intelligence from the affected kind one picks up at college. In the numbers arena, Hazel had always been lacking. She had barely gotten through pre-calculus in high school, and after moving to Seattle for college, she had dived into the arts and humanities with scattershot enthusiasm. Drama, dance, literature, history, sidestepping the hard and fast in favor of the slippery and indefinite. If she had been a member of any other family, she might have been confident in her choices. But with the Severys, Hazel often felt that whenever one of them looked at her, even Lily, who had double majored in comparative literature and mathematics at Berkeley, they weren't really seeing her, but were scanning a set of data points visible only to them, like insects in ultraviolet. She could practically hear them whispering, "Why entrust this one with the letter?" Hazel had been asking herself this very question. As if her grief wasn't enough to bear, she'd now been given this cryptic assignment. She returned Isaac and the rose bushes to the Principia and nervously checked her phone, which set off another sort of anxiety. Why hadn't Bennett's name appeared in the call log?
Why couldn't she rely on him to support her today of all days? First, he had begged off joining her on the trip because of a work emergency, and second, after offering her a ride to the airport, he had diminished the favor by greeting her with a Nikon camera to the face. Though Bennett worked for an artsy furniture design company that promised to blur the line between form and function, between our furniture and ourselves, he nursed loftier creative ambitions outside of work. To that end, he insisted that his emotions project, or whatever he was calling his next art installation, demanded constant photographic vigilance. Click. After examining the shot, he'd said, "I can never capture your sad face. Why is that? Cheerful, stunned, irritated. Never sad. Can you exploit my grief later?" She could, of course, snap a photo of herself now so that her boyfriend might complete his collection. "This is funereal me. Sad enough?" Though at that moment her face more likely betrayed rising panic. Hazel slid her phone back in her pocket, at the same time checking the opposite hip. Her pockets weren't terribly deep. What if the envelope fell out as she sat down? With a mind to concealing the thing safely somewhere, she left the alcove and made straight for the hall, avoiding the populated end of the house. As she turned a corner, she halted at the sight of a middle-aged man in a light herringbone jacket, chatting up a female guest. But it was only Isaac's accountant, Fritz Dornbach. There was comfort in seeing this man whom her grandfather had always liked, and it occurred to her that if she were to confide in anyone, she could do worse than the family's attorney bookkeeper. But then Isaac couldn't have been more clear. "Do not share this with anyone." She stole behind Fritz toward the staircase, which someone had roped off with some tasseled curtain ties, presumably to discourage wandering guests. Hazel ducked under the barrier. The second floor landing was dim, its windows curtained shut. As her pupils adjusted, she made her way past Isaac's study door, where her step triggered a groaning floorboard. The same loose board under which she and her brother had once kept treasures and left each other secret notes. A loose nail pressed up through her shoe, as if a kind of prompt. But she discarded this as a potential hiding place. It was too easy for Gregory to get nostalgic and stumble upon it. Turning to the study door, she imagined herself twisting the glass knob to reveal Isaac on the other side, hunched in a chair, looking up with a patient smile. For a second she even thought she could hear his rhythmic murmuring coming from within, the sound of a mathematician thinking out loud. A murmur of mathematicians. She continued down the hall to her old bedroom, where she was considering staying the next night or two. She had thrown her luggage in her brother's car just in case. Besides, with the house likely going on the market, this could be her last chance to stay in her old room. Whatever dangers Isaac imagined the house posed, he needn't have warned her about not staying past October. She planned to be back in Seattle well before Halloween. The bedroom hadn't changed much over the years. It still contained her adolescent belongings. Stuffed animals, ceramic figurines, a bookshelf filled with childhood reading. At another time, these keepsakes might have brought her comfort. But as her eyes scanned the book's spines, Madeline L'Engle, Ellen Raskin, C.S. Lewis, E.L. Königsberg, Hazel felt bewildered and alone. Had this house ever really felt like home? Or had it always been just another way station in a transient childhood? She and her brother had loved Isaac and Lily deeply, but had never entirely rid themselves of the feeling that they were long-term charity cases, forever crashing on the couch of an intimidatingly distinguished family. For a time, at least, she had successfully smothered this feeling of inexpressible exile. As she pulled the envelope from her pocket and contemplated a hiding place among her Hercule Poirot novels, she took one last look at the contents of the letter, wondering if the desire not to disappoint Isaac over the years had turned into a more general habit of avoidance. What if she chose to do nothing with the letter? She was flying back home in 2 days,
and was hardly in the position to be tracking down a room number she'd never heard of, let alone obliterating her grandfather's legacy. And then to be chasing down some guy named Rasponti? A man apparently fond of only the most popular men's suiting pattern there is? Turning to the window, Hazel thought back to the innocent hours before she'd opened the letter. What had she been expecting? Not this sober directive from the grave, but maybe, Lily no longer recognizes me. My ability to do math is deteriorating. No shame in bowing out gracefully, you understand. But with all his talk of being followed and wishing he could flee, what was she supposed to do with that when he'd forbidden her from going to the police? Could it be that Isaac had lost his foothold on reality, and that these were mad ramblings? Just as she was slipping the letter into Agatha Christie's The Mysterious Affair at Styles, Hazel heard the loose floorboard outside creak. She shelved the book and stepped into the darkened hall just in time to see someone. A man, she couldn't see his face, leaving her grandfather's study. He shut the door and seemed to waver for a moment before disappearing down the stairs. She became aware of a prickling sensation, as if charged particles were scaling her spine. Being alone on the second floor suddenly felt like a bad idea, so she shut the bedroom door and made her way to the social level of the house. Downstairs, she fell into some hugs and nice-to-see-yous before going to the buffet table for something to settle her stomach. When she had filled her plate, she nearly stumbled over little Drew Severy Oliver, who was sitting in the middle of the floor, an Audubon guide open in her lap. Hazel was often blind to the allure of small children, but with Drew, she couldn't help but melt a little. The 5-year-old looked up.
Did you know that the albatross has the widest wingspan of any bird there is?
Really? I had no idea.
Yeah, no one does.
While Drew flipped through her book for more bird facts, Sybil appeared and gave Hazel a sideways embrace.
My little bug isn't bothering you, is she?
Oh no, I'm getting a much-needed ornithology lesson. Birds are her big thing right now, and plants. She's already identified all the plants in our backyard. She's bored with them now, of course. Drew peered up at her mother.
Did she say ornithology?
No, honey, she didn't. Drew bounced toward Hazel.
But you did, didn't you?
Hazel looked to Sybil, who grimaced.
Ornithology is the study of birds, Drew announced.
Drew, please, not now, pleaded her mother.
Orology is the study of mountains. Orthopterology is the study of crickets and grasshoppers.
Oh, God, Sybil said, running a hand through her hair. She's memorized all of the ologies in alphabetical order. When she reaches zoology, she starts all over again. There are hundreds of them. Hundreds. She broke off, exasperated. Well, I'm feeling very inadequate, Hazel said.
Osteology, Drew sang. The study of bones.
She's going to be very smart. Everyone says so. Sybil said in unmasked dismay.
We have to go find Daddy, Drew. Say bye to Hayes. Bye.
Sybil lifted her daughter from the floor and floated away, but not before Hazel heard,
Ovology, the study of eggs.
Nothing like a know-it-all child to make you feel completely worthless. Hazel looked down at her food, realizing she wasn't at all hungry. A drink, that's what she needed. A strong drink would put the letter out of her mind. She headed for the kitchen, first having to circumnavigate the depressed geeks who were closing in on Philip and Paige, the new default celebrities of the family. Without meaning to, Hazel met Paige's eyes again. Her aunt had always been an intimidating figure. Hazel's early memories of her usually involved some odd comment thrown her way that she had been too young or too nervous to comprehend. Only later did she register it as a steady stream of disdain and sarcasm. Hazel mustered a cursory smile at Paige and moved on. Her search of the kitchen cupboards turned up a precious half-bottle of Isaac's rye, perhaps the last of his stores. She took a quick swallow from the bottle before pouring herself a proper glass. In the living room, she noticed a young foursome gathered in a recess, a bronze bust of Copernicus peering out from their animated orbit. From the unconcealed arrogance in their voices, she guessed they were grad students, and from the volume of their conversation that they were happily intoxicated. The bearded man who'd spoken at the funeral stood among them. She saw up close that his hair was a bit of a nest, and that his suit, not herringbone, she noted, but a faint checked pattern, was probably a size too big. His anxious look from that morning had gone, and he was now engaged in confident conversation with a cute brunette. But Hazel sensed his eyes following her, and as she took a seat in a nearby club chair, she could feel a lingering heat from his gaze. The four had moved on from reminiscing about Isaac to complaining about relationships. The brunette grumbled about her computer scientist ex, who was a dead ringer for Albert Camus, but whose broodingly handsome brain case had been empty. "No joke," she said. "I had to explain Riemann Zeta to him like Zeta of S times." Laughs all around. "I bet he was fun, at least," a redhead broke in. "Try dating a number theorist who thinks it's the height of hilarity to celebrate only prime-numbered birthdays. Oh, ha-ha." The beard was still focused on the brunette.
"So you dumped him?"
"Afraid so."
"Hey, I hear you," said the fourth member of the group, a man with unfortunate acne scars. "People who don't get mathematics can be shockingly dull."
"Now, wait a second," Beard interrupted. "Take this book on the shelf here, Numbers, How the History of Mathematics is the History of Civilization. I mean, sure, the history of math is tied to human progress and all that, but the title is meaningless. There are other things to life."
"Like what?"
demanded the brunette.
"Oh, I don't know.
Nature, long naps,
a dog chasing a ball, food."
"You don't think nature is packed with mathematics, or that the advent of agriculture was totally dependent on rudimentary geometry?"
"Sure, but it was also dependent on people being hungry."
The brunette tutted. Hazel couldn't see her face, but she imagined it sucking a cigarette.
"Look," continued Beard, "you can plug in anything. Architecture, how the history of building shit is the history of civilization. Literally anything.
Booze?
How the history of fermentation.
Mustard?
How the history of the spice trade. What's your point?"
"My point is that I'm sick to death of all the pretension, of insisting that the abstract science we call mathematics is more vital than anything else. Because if, God forbid, somebody doesn't memorize the Zeta function for his girlfriend, he's some straw-munching rube."
This wasn't the first time Hazel had heard a heated discussion like this in the Severy house, but it suddenly struck her as hilarious that people actually talked like this.
"You know," the brunette broke in, "speaking of pretentious mathematicians, I wasn't the one who got up at a funeral and made 100 people listen to number garbage for 20 minutes.
"Number garbage."
"That's right."
"Whatever you say," said Beard. But the brunette was already stalking off to the kitchen, her friends right behind her. Beard glowered at his drink as if rebuking his own reflection. When he reoriented himself, his eyes alighted on Hazel. She shifted uncomfortably on her cushion and cleared her throat.
"Big comfy chair. How the history of sitting down," he laughed.
It was a boozy cackle that lasted several seconds and brought an involuntary smile to Hazel's face for the first time in days.
"You heard all that?" he asked.
Feeling self-conscious, she cracked open a book sitting on an end table.
"Oh, no, I was just reading up on," she flipped back the cover, "An Extended Treatise on Mathematical Modeling by Hermann Henke."
He tried not to smile.
"I actually know him. The man is deadly."
Beard suddenly frowned in the direction of the kitchen.
"Christ, I seriously don't know what's wrong with me lately. I've been such a prick."
"You mean to that girl?"
"I wouldn't worry about it."
He planted a hand on Copernicus's bronze face.
"Yeah, I don't really know them anyway. And I'm not apologizing to a mathematician who can't recognize decent math when she hears it."
"It's funny," Hazel said. "I don't think I've ever heard an equation read out loud like that. Definitely not at a funeral."
At this, she was surprised to see him glance away, the skin above his beard reddening.
I guess it was a bit much. Not that I would have understood it had it been written out. He smiled. If you had an hour or two and a basic understanding of differential equations, I could... Oh, don't waste your time. He took a swallow from his glass. I'm probably not that far behind you. My number talents are pretty unspectacular nowadays. Ordinary, even. Hazel half stood so that she was leaning on the chair's arm. I'm Hazel, by the way. Isaac was my grandfather. He gave her an odd, searching look.
I don't believe you.
Oh, it's not biological, she said quickly. I don't have a brain that anyone would want to cut open. When he didn't respond, she kept talking. He told me once I had a mind for logic, but it turns out he was just being nice.
Now that I think of it, maybe I have heard him mention you.
He held up his last bit of whiskey. To Isaac. After tossing it back, he set the glass next to the heliocentrist's shoulder and glanced around the room.
Do you know any of these people?
Hazel followed his gaze. A few. But honestly, without Isaac, I'm a bit lost in crowds like this. He nodded. This was supposed to be my tribe, but all I can say is I know exactly what you mean. He suddenly pulled out his phone and frowned. I'm very sorry, Hazel. I'd like to stay, but I have to be somewhere. I'll see you around. I don't actually live here. Neither do I. She was about to ask his name, but he made a sudden awkward move toward the kitchen, pausing to examine a piece of artwork on the adjoining wall. It was a large red canvas with a snarl of string fixed to the center. He stared at the identifying tag. Found Twine, number 126.
Sybil made that, she explained.
I wonder what the odds are.
Odds?
Of stumbling upon Twine 126 times in your life. He turned away again, but thought better of it.
Sorry, I'm Alex, he said, producing a hand. I should have mentioned that Isaac was also my grandfather, which, if I'm not mistaken, makes us related. Don't mean to rush off, it's just that I'm late. Goodbye, Hazel.
She stood stunned at the front window, watching his rumpled figure move away from the house. Did she really have a cousin she didn't know about? She didn't expect his journey across the vast lawn to clear up her confusion, but she studied his slightly uneven stride as if he were stomping out clues to his identity. She felt her brother step up beside her.
So, you met Paige's spawn?
She turned, eyes wide, and laughed.
Alex is Alexis? Of course.
Insane, right?
Why didn't you tell me?
Gregory shook his head. Just found out from Aunt Jane. What a surprise to discover that our mysterious cousin isn't the pretty girl I imagined, but a wannabe Englishman.
Why would Paige lie like that? Or at least not bother to correct anyone?
I guess it's not a proper joke unless it runs for 30 years.
They watched Alex's figure grow small and vanish down the flight of canyonside steps.
He does have a weird accent.
Jane says he picked it up while in school overseas. Couldn't possibly have been intentional.
I don't know. He seems nice in a neurotic sort of way.
She expected her brother to say something about all his years as a detective for the Los Angeles Police Department and his preternatural ability to know people at a glance. But instead, he put an arm around her.
How'd you turn out to be so generous?
He asked, leaning his head on hers. What once would have been an effortless gesture now felt stilted, as if he were trying to make up for something. Still, she returned his half-embrace, and for that moment she felt close to him again.
It's just terrible you all couldn't have grown up together, their Aunt Jane told them long after the house had emptied. Alex should have been part of the family, but Paige does what she wants, I suppose. Whether it was her insecurity over his not having a proper father or what, that's no reason to go on this long. Though the father isn't exactly some delinquent. Out of the picture, sure, but he's paid for Alex's entire education.
I mean, Philip and I knew that she was a he. Isaac let it slip about a year ago. Said he was bored with Paige's insistence on privacy. But even so, we just met the boy on Friday. Though he's hardly a boy anymore.
Jane poured iced teas and set out a plate of leftovers from the reception. When I confronted Paige yesterday, she grudgingly admitted that her son has great mathematical potential, or did once. He told me that he was ordinary.